Want a more fault-tolerant data center? Bring the availability of cloud computing inside your data center with the only server built from the cloud up.
Welcome back to another episode of TechNet Radio. My name is Keith Mayer. I'm a senior technical evangelist at Microsoft, and today I have with me my good friend and colleague, Matt Hester. Hey, Matt, how's it going today?
Hey, good. How are you doing, Keith? I can't wait to learn what you're going to talk about this time. I mean, this is our third part in this series. We've had some really good things to talk about R2 around some of the basics of some of the improvements we've had around storage and virtualization. So I'm excited about today's topic. I think we're going to be talking about networking. Is that right?
Yeah, we're going to be looking at some of the new networking capabilities that are in the forthcoming release of Windows Server 2012 R2 that, let's see, I think we'll be releasing on October 18th, right?
Yep, October 18th is when everybody can get their hands, and some folks, if they're a TechNet or MSDN subscriber, are getting their hands on it today.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and what I'm really excited about is a lot of these new features we've been talking about in our Build Your Hybrid Cloud series are features that empower our full cloud OS story. They bring a lot of cool new cloud-type capabilities to our on-premises Windows Server 2012 platform that we're using to virtualize our workloads and be able to deliver some really scalable applications. And as we've talked about in the last couple episodes, our cloud OS story extends beyond just your on-premises data center. It encompasses a whole family of devices running tablets or desktops or phone devices, even gaming consoles with the Windows interface in it so that your users can have access to the applications that matter most to them consistently with a consistent interface across those devices. But from more importantly, from our standpoint as IT professionals, when we look at the back end of where those applications are talking to, it allows us to leverage the right combination of on-premises servers running Server 2012 R2 and cloud-based server resources like those that are available through our Windows Azure cloud platform. So whether we're using Hyper-V on-premises or virtualizing up in Windows Azure, like our Xbox, Bing, Office 365, and SkyDrive applications do today, we've got a consistent set of interfaces to allow our applications to be managed, to be authenticated, and to connect back to those resources that are in our data center or our virtual data center sitting up in Windows Azure. Tools like Active Directory, System Center, Windows Intune, Office 365, Visual Studio, TFS from a development standpoint, allowing us as IT pros and developers to also have a very consistent experience for managing and deploying these applications. And when we think about these technologies then, really there's been growing interest around the idea of a hybrid cloud. A hybrid cloud is a cloud that's not just private to your organization from an on-premises perspective, but private to your organization and extends across premises, being able to leverage on-premises resources and resources that are up in a public cloud like Windows Azure in a secure way that's private and scalable to your business needs. And in this series, we've been spending a lot of time talking up front about Windows Server 2012 R2 because it's the foundation of our on-premises cloud infrastructure. But as we proceed through the next few episodes in the series, we'll be getting into some of the other new tools that are also launching around that same October timeframe, System Center 2012 R2, from a management, private cloud management standpoint, the Windows Azure Pack, which allows us to provide a very Azure-like self-service interface on top of our on-premises clouds, and then Hyper-V Recovery Manager, which is a cool capability that allows us to orchestrate site-to-site disaster recovery and failover of entire private clouds between our primary site and a secondary location where we may have other data center resources. So today we're going to finish off talking about some of the core new capabilities of Server 2012 R2 around networking today. So the last couple episodes we've talked a lot about storage, server virtualization, today we're going to get into networking. And networking, I don't know if you agree, Matt, but when I've been out in the field, I've always looked at networking as sort of the nerve center of a data center, because of the way that the focus that it has in terms of being so instrumental for allowing applications to be able to communicate back and forth, whether those applications are communicating between servers within your data center or out to clients that are on premises or perhaps even remote clients. And it really has a critical key role. And I've seen that role even be more impactful now that most data center environments are starting to think about consolidating a lot of their workloads across client application traffic, storage traffic, management traffic, cluster traffic, all under a set of higher speed interfaces, leveraging, you know, multiple 1 gig or 10 gig interfaces. But Matt, that's just my perspective. What do you see out in the field? Do you see anything similar to that, or are you seeing differences in terms of how networking is being deployed today?
Well, and when I think about this networking in general, you're exactly right. It's, you know, our servers are very important, and the applications of the servers are really important. But if you want to see how important something is go cut a network cable and disconnect that server from the rest of the network. Now, by the way, don't do that. That's bad.
Yeah.
But the point is if we can't get connected to the network, whether it's a private cloud or a public cloud, if we can't get up into those environments, we can't do our jobs. It's vital to this. But I think more importantly is when you think about all the traffic that's out there. I mean, imagine what, 10 years ago, could you have imagined a 10 gig network? I mean, could you imagine having that much bandwidth? And we have, I mean, 1 gig is like, you know, really big. And I think 10 gigs finally starting to catch on. At least all the routers are starting to support it, even though we might actually support it from everything. And that's something we'll talk about today. But I think what's important is when we think about all the traffic that's going across it. You know, it's not just about our file servers and our print servers and our virtualization workloads. You have voice traffic going over that now. You have all, I mean, everybody's phones seem to have a, you know, a cat cable hanging out the back end trying to do connection to it. So it's become really the mission critical types of things that we do inside of our networking. And I'm excited to hear what we have in R2 today, because I know we've talked about R2 isn't just a service pack. This is a brand new release, and I've seen some of the networking stuff we're going to talk about today, and I don't want to steal any of your thunder, but it's really exciting to see what we can actually do now with software and traditionally things that used to be done by the routers themselves, which I could argue that the router had software inside of it. We're just now putting the software on our base OS.
Yeah, definitely, and your point's well taken about the speed increases of network interfaces. Commonly today, we see 1 gig and more even 10 gig Ethernet being deployed as consolidated interfaces in the data center between servers for multiple server communication needs. But when R2 was being planned and developed, we also took a look forward into what's next in terms of commodity network adapters. What's the next speed limits? And so a lot of the improvements you'll see from a networking perspective in R2 also, hold on to your seats, support improved communication and scalability across 40 gig Ethernet and 56 gig InfiniBand connections. I mean, we're getting to the point that with some of these brand new network interfaces with speeds of 40 and 56 gig, you team a couple of those together and you're starting to compete with more proprietary fiber channel type interfaces from days gone by. It's really, really impressive. Have you seen any 40 or 56 gig interfaces in your data centers yet, Matt?
No, and let me be the first one to say, we're never going to need that much bandwidth, ever. We're not going to need it. I don't know why they're building it. It'll be nice that it's there. I mean, it's one of those things that will be interesting, the uptick of it. Because when I think about networking, you know, I grew up in the days of IPv4 and the sky is falling because we're going to run on IP addresses. And then this wonderful thing called NAT came along. And I still have yet to see people going to IPv6, although we've been supporting that for a long time in the products. Even though we have some features and functions like direct access that require it, I think what's great about it is that we're going to have all this stuff in place that when we get to that 50 gig, when there actually is a legitimate need, although I think some people, especially the gamers, you know, World of Warcraft people saying, I need 50 gig right now. In reality, how much do we actually need in the things? I mean, we're getting more and more data, but what's going to happen? And the fact that it might be a couple years away and we already have it into our, or baking it into our DNA of our servers is nothing but a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, the way I look at it is when we start thinking about normal networking interfaces on servers being used for storage for heavy-duty disk I/O based workloads or being used for live migrating dozens of virtual machines concurrently in a scaled up configuration, that's kind of where I see those additional speeds being really powerful and much more cost effective than traditional fiber channel host bus adapters and fiber channel switches and fiber cabling infrastructure and whatnot. And but even with 1 gig and 10 gig, we've seen some really interesting designs that our customers and our hosting partners have been using with Server 2012 and System Center 2012 to date. And I just wanted to review a couple of those because that'll make, I think, that'll help bring some context around why we've started implementing some of the new features from a networking capability standpoint in the R2 releases. So one of the designs that we've seen a lot of interest and a lot of success in deploying is a scale-up design. You know, as we talked about in episode 2, our server virtualization episode, Server 2012, from a Hyper-V standpoint, has the ability to support gobs of memory and logical processors, up to 4 terabytes of memory, 320 logical processors, to do some really heavy-duty, scaled-up workloads on a single server. And when you start having a couple servers in place for perhaps high availability clustering and whatnot, you start having to think about, well, how can I easily move those interface, those virtual machines back and forth for planned maintenance between my various hosts? And so you start thinking about the speed and resiliency of your network interfaces. And from that standpoint, we saw a lot of interest in Server 2012 R2 around the built-in NIC teaming support that allows us to take up to 32 NICs and team them into a resilient load balance bundle. One of the challenges that we saw with that, though, in a scaled-up configuration is if you only have a couple, 2 or 3 Hyper-V hosts, and you're perhaps doing live migrations, we'll say, between them of lots of VMs, the load balancing that NIC teaming offered in Server 2012, it was great for load balancing virtual machine workloads that are going out to the clients for network traffic coming from the virtual machines. But when you have host-to-host communication, most of the load balancing was kind of negated a little bit because it only had 2 IP addresses to load balance a ton of traffic across, the source and the destination for this huge amount of traffic when you're live migrating VMs. And similarly, we look at more of a scaled out configuration where we start thinking about, well, how can we take advantage of spreading storage through maybe a couple highly available file server cluster, file servers through a scale out file server cluster? How can we think about spreading that storage across our Hyper-V hosts? We again have kind of the same strategy where we have a small number of hosts communicating to a small number of hosts. So in 2012, the NIC teaming and load balancing was great if you had lots of VMs that you were load balancing across or lots of physical devices that you were load balancing it across. But when you only had a couple on each side, like in these configurations, sometimes you weren't able to squeeze all that network utilization that was possible out of your teamed interfaces. So we've got some improvements in 2012 R2 to address that. The other big area that we saw is that with very heavy network I/O. A lot of network adapters that you plug into data center servers today offer RSS, receive side scaling, to spread heavy network traffic across the physical CPU cores on a physical host so that one CPU core doesn't get pegged with handling all of the network I/O. And that works great until you have a single VM that itself has very heavy I/O, because even if we give that single VM multiple cores, multiple virtual cores inside of it, there was no ability to map RSS in Server 2012 into the VM itself to allow the VM to take advantage of RSS support. So RSS would provide the ability to spread out broadly the overall communication at a host level, but not allow the VMs to be aware of it and take advantage of it if one or two VMs themselves had very heavy network needs. So some of the new features that we've got in Server 2012 R2 are designed to address specifically that. We've got virtualized RSS support, so that we can now make our VMs, if we've got applications running in a VM that are very network I/O bound, we can give a VM multiple cores and enable RSS inside the VM, allowing it to spread its network traffic across its virtual cores. We've also got some new improvements to NIC teaming. This is one that I'm really excited about. We've got a new kind of industry-leading Flowlet-based NIC teaming load balancing algorithm that allows us to dynamically chop a stream of traffic between just a couple hosts into a set of Flowlets and load balance them efficiently across multiple network paths without having to be impacted by any type of like TCP segment reordering, packet reordering, things of that nature. So it's allowing us to fully utilize all of the bandwidth in our teamed interfaces, even in configurations where we're doing a lot of communication just between a couple hosts, like batch live migrations or lots of storage traffic or whatnot. And we've also got a cool feature built into the Hyper-V switch itself called extended port ACLs that allow us to better control security from a Hyper-V virtual switch standpoint when we're setting up communications between various VMs or between the outside world, the world outside that Hyper-V host, and the VMs that are running on that host. So those are all cool features that are built into the core of Server 2012 R2. And then we've got some features that Server 2012 R2 supports the foundation of, and System Center supports the management of. So when we think about network virtualization, being able to virtualize our multiple networks, our multiple subnets of VMs in an isolated manner away from each other, for maybe isolated dev and test environments, or if you're a hosting partner, isolated networks for each tenant. We've got improved support around network virtualization. We've even got an inbox network virtualization gateway in Server 2012 R2 that System Center can use to create a bridge between virtual networks and the rest of your physical networking world in your data center. And then we've got also improved IPAM support, so that for IP address management, we can consolidate down a view of IP addresses that are in use on our virtual networks as well as our physical subnets into one consolidated view for managing DNS, for managing DHCP and whatnot across all of those devices. So Matt, what do you think? Does this make sense from your standpoint? I mean, are these network features that you think you might use in some of the data centers that you visited in the past?
You know, I think from a standpoint, customers are going to be really excited, and the virtual RSS one just kind of makes me laugh because I can just imagine the conversation that goes on between Hyper-V and the guest and say, you know, the network comes up to the Hyper-V and says, hey, I have, you know, 40 gig for you because I have this big team with RSS. Nah, I only need 500 meg of that. You know, you can keep the rest of it. I'm not going to use the rest of it. So it's nice that we're thinking about these things to make sure the technology. I mean, it's kind of similar to what we're doing with a lot of virtualization technologies. We're basically enabling Hyper-V to take advantage down to the hardware. And I know we learned in 2012, we take a look at some of the things and you're going to show us here in the demos, some of the things to improve hardware acceleration, saying, why should we try to do things that the hardware card can do better, but let's enable our hypervisor to pass that workload off to that hardware, or to, in the case of virtual RSS, pass it over to those APIs so it can do the work for Hyper-V. So I think what you see a sense is Hyper-V kind of getting out of the game of things it doesn't do well. I mean, Hyper-V does virtualization great. Doesn't mean it does storage great. Doesn't mean it doesn't do networking great. But when we talk about this in the last couple episodes, we see that core OS does that stuff great. And Hyper-V is just passing off the workload. So when we take a look at these things that we're going to see today, I get excited for a couple reasons, because we're letting our OS shine and Hyper-V just leverage the greatness that's there. And it's not just for virtualization that we see a lot of these things that people are going to benefit from. It's going to be other applications that might be able to take over the flow-based NIC or the ACLs that we're going to put in. Well, ACLs are more Hyper-V based, but the point is other functions can take advantage of this core server. We focus a lot on Hyper-V and virtualization because that's where a lot of the data centers are in, but it's nice that we think about a lot of other things that the servers can really improve those features and functions as well.
Sure, definitely. Well, what do you think, Matt? We've talked about these features. Should we go over into the lab and take a look at them live together?
Yeah, and personally, I'm really excited for the demos because, folks, guess what? To do any of this stuff right now, unless you're going to use VMM, which Keith is going to show you in another episode, you have to use PowerShell. So if you're one of the few people that haven't learned PowerShell, now is the time to learn it. I'll make sure we'll get some links for learning PowerShell into this. But, folks, if you haven't learned PowerShell, it is just becoming a bigger part of what we do from an automation perspective. It is a free tool. Pretty much every product that we have, and even a lot of third-party products, I think my favorite thing, one of the most popular third-party add-ons for VMware is the Power CLI, which is basically their PowerShell extension for their VMware environment. So it tells you that one of our largest virtualization competitors is adopting PowerShell, and it's something you should do as well.
Yep, definitely. PowerShell, as networking collapses into the virtualization layer of our hypervisors, PowerShell is quickly becoming the replacement for what network engineers traditionally used in terms of Cisco IOS or other CLIs for physical routers and switches. In the virtualized world, PowerShell is your replacement for that router and switch CLI as more of this collapses into the hypervisor layer. Well, great. Well, let's switch over into the lab and take a look at these features together. Okay, Matt, well, here we are in our lab environment, and we're looking at the Server Manager tool for one of our newly installed Windows Server 2012 R2 Hyper-V hosts. I'm on the local server page, and I promise we'll get into PowerShell in just a moment. But before we get into PowerShell, I wanted to show you a little bit about nick teaming, because we don't need to use PowerShell for nick teaming. We could. There's a whole set of nick teaming PowerShell commandlets that you could use to automate the setup of this. But we also have a GUI tool for nick teaming that's integrated into Server Manager. And on this local server page, you'll see that I've got nick teaming listed, and I've got four physical Ethernet adapters that are in this particular server. Now I'm going to go over to where it says disabled currently for nick teaming, and I'm just going to click on that disabled link, and that'll bring up our nick teaming wizard. So on this particular server, it's kind of a low-end server. I only have gigabit interfaces. I don't have any 40 or 56 gig interfaces on it. But here are my four individual interfaces, Ethernet 1 through 4. I'm just going to select them by shift-clicking. And on my tasks pane, my tasks list, I'm going to add them to a new team. And that'll bring up my new team dialog box. And we'll say that this is the demo team. So I've got a name for my team, and I've got my various adapters, all four adapters that are being teamed together. So once I'm done, this will be the aggregate of a single 4 gigabit connection that my traffic will be load balanced across, and it'll be resilient. If any of these adapters or their cables fail, automatically it'll fall back to the remaining adapters that still have a valid connection. Now, nick teaming in a lot of networking environments requires intelligent switches, but not in Hyper-V. In Server 2012 and Server 2012 R2, we can certainly support intelligent switches that support either static Ether channel configurations or dynamic link aggregation control protocol, LACP configurations, but we also have the ability to do nick teaming over really just any standard switches using switch independent configuration for our teaming mode. So even non-intelligent switches we can team over. And you'll notice that down on the next field where it says load balancing mode, I've got a new value here. It defaults to dynamic. Dynamic is that new load balancing mode that I was talking about a few moments ago that chops up our configuration, our network traffic rather, into those flowlets and allows us to more efficiently balance network traffic across our available interfaces in the team, even if we're communicating just between a couple hosts. So if we're doing live migrations or whatnot, it works out well. You can think of dynamic as also being a great cross between the other two load balancing modes that Server 2012 introduced, address hashing and Hyper-V port. So it used to be in Server 2012 that if you primarily were doing nick teaming for VMs, you'd probably choose the Hyper-V port load balancing mode. If you're primarily doing load balancing of physical traffic coming out at the host level of a server, you'd use address hashing. Well, now dynamic, with the improvements that we're seeing across utilization, is kind of a best of both worlds. We still support the older load balancing modes in case that's a standard that you've committed to in your environment. But going forward, we recommend really working with dynamic as the choice for getting the most out of your network adapters. So I'm going to go ahead, click OK, and it created my new team. It looks like a couple of my adapters aren't currently connected to cables, so it's showing me a fault there, which is fine. It's no problem at all. Now that I have my new team, though, you'll see it appear over here, my demo team. I can, if we were talking about consolidation of multiple network streams across that team, well, if I go over to team interfaces, I can take this this NIC team and actually add multiple team interfaces to that single NIC. So if I wanted to break out my storage traffic, maybe I'm using iSCSI to connect to an iSCSI SAN, if I wanted to break that out and have that go over VLAN 2, I can do that. It'll create another interface that breaks out all of my storage traffic across this team. I can add an interface for my cluster heartbeat traffic, we'll say. And maybe for cluster traffic between my hosts, I want that to go over a separate VLAN, maybe over VLAN 3, for instance. And then I've got my client VM traffic, so I can add an interface for that. And we'll say that that's going to be my client traffic, and that's going to go over VLAN 4. And then finally, I might add a final team interface for perhaps live migration traffic and have that go over perhaps VLAN 5, for instance. So now I've got four separate logical interfaces in addition to my default interface that all point to that same physical team, but they're tagged with separate VLANs. So now at a switch layer, I can use QoS, I can use ACLs and whatnot to be able to prioritize and control that traffic more effectively over a single set of teamed interfaces. So consolidating all of your traffic down, managing over standard Ethernet, and reducing the overall cost. What do you think, Matt? Does that make sense from your standpoint?
Yeah, definitely from that standpoint. I was going to ask, and you just answered that question, why would somebody want to do this? Because you just gave me four VLANs, and I'm like, well, we started with four NICs. Why just not use each NIC for each kind of traffic? And I get the concept of it. It's for that other back end of the QoS services and be able to really kind of control those interfaces. And it's really, the nice thing, once again, I said it before, is it's built into servers. So anything else that we want to do can use this kind of traffic and use this kind of teaming capability. So.
Yep, definitely. And once, while we were talking, I plugged in my network interfaces, so you can see those interfaces are now active and ready to start load balancing across. And in addition to the QoS support, the other advantage that we have here is also resiliency, because if we dedicated each of those traffic patterns to just one physical NIC, and that NIC or its cable went down, we'd be out of luck. We're here, it's a resilient NIC team. If any interface goes down, all of the VLANs will continue to operate over the remaining physical NICs. So that's a pretty cool feature, all built in, and we'll see that once our NIC team is created, instead of showing the physical interfaces in Server Manager, now we see those logical team interfaces along with the IP addresses that are assigned. We can click right in to be able to manage those individually. So they show up as just standard interfaces within our Network Connections folder. Great. Well, in addition to the improvements around NIC teaming, we also talked about some improvements that were more related to Hyper-V virtual switching as well. So let me go over into Hyper-V Manager, and we'll take a look at some of those virtual network settings. Now, as you and a lot of our IT pros in the audience know, Matt, in Server 2012, if we went into the settings of a virtual machine, we had lots of great advanced features to be able to enable for virtual NICs on our VMs. We had the ability to have virtual NICs associated with a particular VLAN, or to enable bandwidth management, QoS, at a virtual machine by virtual machine, virtual NIC by virtual NIC basis. We also have support for hardware acceleration with support for items like virtual machine queuing, IPsec task offloading, and SRIOV, single root IO virtualization. And then we had some features that were more related to how the VM communicates across the network. Things like enabling MAC address spoofing if you were using load balancing, for instance, of multiple VMs behind a common MAC address or set of MAC addresses. Security features like DHCP and Router Guard to prevent someone from setting up a virtual machine on your network that spoofs a legitimate DHCP server or spoofs a legitimate router by protecting against the VM being able to send that kind of traffic out. So the hypervisor administrator can block that at a hypervisor level. And even if someone goes inside the VM's operating system and tries to install DHCP or RRAS or whatnot, we don't have to worry about that traffic coming out onto the network. We had port mirroring support and support for NIC teaming within a VM. So we can enable multiple virtual NICs inside of a VM and check that last box and be able to tell Hyper-V that the virtual machine is also going to do NIC teaming across its virtual NICs. But we have a new feature here that we didn't have before. called Protected Network. Protected Network is actually a new networking feature that R2 exposes for virtual machines as it pertains to a clustered environment. As you know, when we have multiple hypervisor hosts using the built-in Windows Server failover clustering, we can create a highly available configuration where if a cluster host fails, we can have the virtual machines that were running on that cluster host fail over to the surviving cluster hosts, the surviving hosts in the cluster. What this protected network does is it allows the cluster to also monitor that the VM's network connectivity to the physical network is also healthy. And if it sees that a VM got disconnected, perhaps because somebody pulled the cable out of one host at a host level, it'll automatically flag that if we enable protected network as a situation to fail that VM over to one of the other cluster hosts that still has network connectivity. So it allows us to have clustering much more aware not only of the health of the host, but the health of the VM's path through that host into your physical network environment. So it's a pretty cool feature.
So when you look at those are per VM kind of settings.
They are.
But when I think about some of the stuff that we talked about before, like virtual RS and the virtual switch, do we have to do that per VM? Because I didn't see any of those settings for that. Is that something that we set up on the actual Hyper-V host itself?
So we would still configure it on a VM by VM basis from within the Hyper-V host. We don't have to go into the guest OS independently, but we'd still configure it on a VM by VM basis. But we configure those items, the virtual RSS support and the ability to use extended port ACLs, through PowerShell. We could actually do all of these advanced features through PowerShell. Some of them, though, like the ones we're showing here, are exposed graphically through the Hyper-V Manager GUI. So that provides a great segue over into PowerShell. You ready to join me over in PowerShell, Matt?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, let's cancel out of this. I'm going to go over to my PowerShell integrated scripting environment, which I think I have open. There we are. And let's talk about virtual RSS support first. So the great thing about virtual RSS support inside of a VM is that we don't really need to do anything more than what we did at a host level to enable RSS support for a VM running on that host. And what I mean by that is at a host level, in Server 2012, if we wanted to enable virtual RSS, we have a set of PowerShell commandlets to enable or disable it, or set a particular profile for it. So if I get my network adapter status, we can see first, is virtual RSS enabled? It is. It's listed as true. And if it wasn't, I could enable it for all network interfaces on this host, disable it on the host, or change it to a different RSS profile. Normally, the default profile is sufficient in most cases, but if you get into some advanced multiprocessor configurations on a host, we're using, you know, kind of a scale-up situation where you have lots of NUMA nodes collecting your processors and memory together, you can customize the profile to a dynamic load balancing profile of RSS traffic that's NUMA aware, where it'll dynamically balance the network traffic across multiple CPU cores. So this is what we would do typically at a host level. The great news is if we wanted to enable in the R2 release a particular guest to take advantage of RSS, we could establish a remote PowerShell session to that guest and simply use these same commands to enable the support in the guest. Just doing an enable netadapter RSS dash name star, boom, that guest is now enabled for virtual RSS, and if we've given it multiple virtual CPUs, it'll start taking advantage of each of the CPUs inside of it for handling heavy network traffic that virtual machine might be generating. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's awesome. So it's the same commandlet, whether it's a virtual machine or a physical host. Yep. It's the same exact steps. That's fantastic. It makes it a lot easier to learn and adopt those kind of technologies.
Yeah, definitely. And then the port ACL support. Now, if you're a Cisco guy in the audience or a networking guy, some of this might look familiar to you. It's the kind of the PowerShell version of an ACL command line language. The ACL stuff allows us to put per VM, per virtual network adapter, ACLs on controlling source and destination traffic in and out of each of our virtual machines through the Hyper-V virtual network switch. So much like in a physical firewall or physical router. We might have ACLs to control traffic between subnets. We can do all of that between VMs, right, or between VMs in the physical world, right within the Hyper-V network switch. And we use PowerShell as our command line interface to do that. And as I started thinking about this, I thought, you know, that's really interesting, because when I look at the network traces in my data centers that I've been in the past, what I've been seeing is a growing amount of network traffic from VM to VM on the same host. And what that means is we've got, you know, in some cases I've seen as much as 70 to 80% of the network traffic in my data center being between VMs on the same host. What that means is that if we don't have this extended networking support, like ACLs and whatnot, in the virtual switch, in the hypervisor itself, we've got the bulk of our communication that's bypassing our physical routers and switches where traditionally we've set those ACL rules. So having this in the virtual switch is cool. Now, in Server 2012, we had basic ACL support. We had that available to us through a few PowerShell commands, add VM network adapter ACL, get VM network adapter ACL, and remove VM network adapter ACL, where we'd specify the name of one or more VMs. And then the basic ACL support was based on just IP address ACL. So any traffic from this IP address inbound, or any traffic to this IP address outbound, we could allow or deny by adding a set of adapter ACLs. But with Server 2012 R2, we can be much more granular when we're setting our access control lists with extended ACLs. What we've got now are an add, remove, and get PowerShell commandlet for extended ACLs that allow us to go down to the individual protocol and port level. So we can specify inbound or outbound access control lists that allow certain inbound traffic. In this case, this is allowing RDP traffic inbound, or certain outbound traffic, in this case allowing normal web traffic outbound, from the VM itself, irregardless of how any operating system level firewall is configured inside the VM. We can set this at the virtual switch itself and control that traffic, so that if I'm the hypervisor administrator and I'm exposing certain VMs to maybe my dev team, I don't have to worry about how that dev team might disable or configure their Windows firewall inside the VM. I can set all this stuff at the hypervisor level outside the VM and block or allow the traffic that I want. Now, the other piece that we have with extended ACLs is stateful support, a lot like a stateful firewall, where we can say when we see an inbound connection coming into this port, if I use the stateful flag when I set that ACL, it'll watch that inbound connection and automatically open the source port on the other side just for the period of time that's needed to communicate through that inbound session. Similarly, for outbound traffic, if I'm allowing outbound traffic to maybe a web server outbound, I can use the stateful flag to just allow my source port to that destination, just open long enough for while that session is active. And I can also associate timeouts with that stateful session. So after a certain number of a certain period of time, I can close down that stateful connection. So a lot of the stateful capabilities that traditionally you've seen in firewalls or advanced layer 3 routers, we're starting to see here. Now, we don't have any ability to do traffic inspection of the payload like many stateful firewalls would do today out of the box, but that's where our extensible switch support comes in. We've got some great partners that offer their own extensions that plug right in to our Hyper-V extensible virtual switch. Five9, for instance, has a security add-in that allows us to add stateful firewall inspection right into the virtual switch itself. So we can use these PowerShell commands easily to first see if there's any extended ACLs on a particular VM. Let me go ahead and run this. Nothing. The VM doesn't have any extended ACLs. And then we can add one or more extended ACLs just by using the add VM network adapter extended ACL commandlet. So let me go ahead and run that. And now if I get my list, I should see if everything worked. There's my one firewall rule, and it would show all of them if I had more than one. We can also remove them out of the list by using the remove network extended ACL commandlet. So we can remove all of them at once, or we can remove them just based on certain weights. So in the extended ACL list, you'll notice that each of my ACL command lines have a weight associated with them. That weight specifies the order that the ACLs are processed in. So as it hits a match, it'll hit the first one based on its weighting and process that and won't go any further. So if I wanted to remove all of the extended ACLs with a weight of 100, for instance, or in this case a weight of 10, which is the one that I added in, I can simply run that command and it'll remove that particular weighting. It's asking me for, on my command line, I forgot to specify a direction. So it's prompting me and telling me in the magic of PowerShell, hey, dummy, you forgot the direction parameter. And it'll ask me to specify that manually. So I could have put a dash direction inbound to have that listed as well. And now that I'm all set, I've got that removed, I should be back to having no extended ACLs again. So very similar process to how a firewall or a router administrator would administer ACLs like this on a layer 3 physical device. We can now do right from within the PowerShell console. We could script it all out and have a standard script that we use for securing VMs across all of our Hyper-V hosts and be able to automate that process very easily. What do you think, Matt? Does that make sense from your standpoint?
Yeah, it's almost like you're raising and lowering the drawbridge for that traffic to come in and out of the systems, especially
exactly.
To enable, you know, folks if they don't have the ability to have routers that do some of that stuff or the ability to configure it. It's all done via our wonderful friend PowerShell. So this is just amazing stuff, and I think at least for me, my brain's swimming a little bit, and I think the people watching this, their brains are probably swimming a little bit of the kind of possibilities that we can do with some of the networking stuff that's really coming out of the box with Windows Server 2012.
Great. Well, why don't we go back over to our office and we'll finish up our session today. So today in our lab, we looked at some of the networking improvements that have been made in Server 2012 in our new upcoming R2 release. Some of the other networking improvements that are more virtual machine manager related to the System Center 2012 R2 release, we'll be looking at in a forthcoming episode when we start moving into System Center 2012 R2. But wanted to thank you, Matt, for joining us today and adding your input and insight into our episode.
My pleasure, and I think I'm looking forward to that VMM stuff because my first thought, what, there's more? I mean, isn't this enough already? So I'd be excited to see what else we have coming down the pipe.
Definitely. And thank you, everyone, for attending our episode today as well. If you're interested in playing around with any of the new features that we've been talking about in our episode, got some great resources for you that you can explore online. First, we've got our online set of step-by-step Cloud Lab documents for building your own lab environment up in the cloud, leveraging our Windows Azure Infrastructure Services platform. At any point in time, you can open up your browser and browse out to aka.ms/cloudlab to be able to peruse those different step-by-step guides. In addition, we'll be including this episode in our Build Your Private Cloud series and updating our content in that series to reflect the new hybrid capabilities that the R2 releases of Windows Server 2012 and System Center 2012 offer. So be sure to check out aka.ms/buildyourcloud for some additional resources and step-by-step guidance that relate to building your hybrid cloud solutions on top of our latest R2 platforms solutions. Thanks so much for joining us today. Look forward to seeing you back at a future episode of TechNet Radio. Thanks, everybody.